Sports Talk New York with your hosts Mark Rosenman and AJ Carter. Sports Talk New York is sponsored in part by Prince Associates, Send In The Clowns, The Phoenix Tube Company, CelebrityTrips.com, the law firm of Decalator Cohen and DePrisco, Solomon Jewelers, and Relish Restaurant of Kings Park. Here are your hosts, Mark and AJ.
Before Marv Albert and Bob Costas, there was Marty Glickman, a gifted Jewish-American athlete who was denied the chance to represent the U.S. at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. He went on to become one of the most revered and influential sportscasters in history, pioneering many of the techniques, phrases, and programming innovations that are commonplace in sports reporting today. Chronicling his remarkable life and career, Glickman debuts tomorrow night, August 26th, 9 p.m. on HBO. It is our pleasure to welcome the man who wrote, produced, directed this marvelous film, James L. Friedman, to Sports Talk New York to talk about the late, great Marty Glickman and the film. Welcome, James.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. It's obvious from the film that you had a tremendous amount of respect for Marty and what he represented. You produced Marty's late-night sports program on New York radio when you were a high school senior. So do you remember the first time you met Marty, and what was it like working for him? I have to imagine that it's got to be a little bit intimidating working for a legend while you're in high school.
You know, that's what you would have thought, but I'll tell you how I got the job, and then you'll understand it was actually the complete reverse of that. I was a 17-year-old high school kid, and I used to drive into Manhattan with my older brother and watch him produce Marty Glickman's late-night radio show on WNEW. Now, this was a groundbreaking show at the time. It was one of the first all-sports call-in shows in the nation. One day, I'm sitting in the booth when my brother tells Marty he's been called up to the Army Reserves, and Marty will need to find another producer. Without missing a beat, Marty pointed directly into the booth at me and said, "Jimmy can do it." And I literally turned around expecting to see another guy named Jimmy sitting there. There wasn't, and for the rest of that year, I produced his show. He taught me how to get the scores off the wire. Do they still have the wire? write them up, schedule commercial screen calls. Pretty heady stuff for a 17-year-old kid. But my experience, what I took away from that, is that Marty Glickman never treated me like some high school kid. He always treated me as his producer, and frankly, it gave me a professional confidence that I have to this very day.
That's unbelievable. Now, I'm in my early 50s, so aside from his broadcasting career, I'm well aware of his athletic prowess, as well as...
Few people are.
Right. Well, the fact that I'm also Jewish, so I know of his background. I can't believe that it's been 12 years since Marty passed away, and it's been 21 years since he called that last Jet game. So there's an entire generation that really has no idea of who Marty Glickman is. Can you take us back to his Flatbush Flash days and what transpired in the 1936 Olympics?
Yes. To start with, most people in New York knew Marty Glickman as either the voice of the Giants or the voice of the Jets. The people older than me even knew him as the voice of the New York Knicks, where he was a groundbreaking, revolutionized sports broadcasting, which we'll get into hopefully in a few minutes. But Marty Glickman, because he never talked about it on the air, to him the game was the thing. He never mentioned his athletic achievements. He was a world-class athlete. He was an All-Eastern, All-American football player at Syracuse. And at one time, in 1936, he was the third fastest runner in the world behind Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf. And he made the 1936 Olympic team. And in the Olympic trials, it looks like he comes in third in the race, and the top three finishers get to run the 100-meter dash. And he was pushed down to fifth, because the coach of the team was the USC coach, and he moved the two USC runners ahead of Marty, and back then they did not have photo finish. So Marty ended up going to Berlin as part of the 400-meter relay team. Now, this was not the Nazi Olympics of Adolf Hitler, where he was espousing the myth of Aryan supremacy, and then went ahead and had to watch all the U.S. black athletes, Jesse Owens, John Woodruff, Ralph Metcalf, just as Marty says, smashed to smithereens this myth. And then the next scheduled race was the 400-meter relay, which Marty Glickman and the other Jewish member on the team, Sam Stoller, were scheduled to run. Now, by all accounts, we were favored to win by 15 yards, and the only way we would lose was if we dropped the baton. The morning of the race, the coaches of the U.S. told Marty and Sam Stoller that the Germans were hiding world-class runners to upset the American team in the 400-meter relay. Now, first of all, it was an out-and-out lie because you can't hide world-class runners. They had to have run to become world-class. And the Germans, Marty was replaced, and Sam Stoller was, the two Jewish runners were replaced by Owens and Metcalf. We ended up winning by the 15 yards everyone said we would have won by. And many people believe that Avery Brundage, the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, who was later to be known as a Nazi sympathizer, was appeasing Hitler because Hitler did not want to see two Jewish runners on the victory podium. And in fact, the film points out, 2 years after the Olympics, when the Nazis were building the German embassy in World War II, in Washington, D.C., the German government awarded the construction contract to Avery Brundage's construction company. So clearly, they were paying off a debt. So Marty never got to run. He never got to run in 40 and 44 because of World War II. So this was his last chance. And Sam Stoller, in fact, was told he wasn't going to run on his 21st birthday. And, you know, happy birthday, Sam. And when I realized this, and, you know, Marty never talked about this except every 4 years he would be asked during the Olympics. And he always spoke about it then because he didn't want this to happen again to anyone else. And he went back to Berlin 50 years later, and all this anger came out of him when he walked on the track and realized what had been taken from him and that he didn't get a chance to run. Anger he didn't know he had within himself. And it wasn't as if he was just angry of what happened to him, but how could they do that to any 18-year-old kid? And I realized when I saw that footage, I had what the heart of my film was. And the heart of my film was what happens when an 18-year-old's dreams are crushed by racism and prejudice. Do they become bitter, or do they triumph in life? Well, Marty Glickman not only triumphed, but he ended up using sports as a means of transcending the divisions created by race, class, and religion. He was a remarkable man.
It's amazing, too, that when you see the film and you see the whole story about Avery Brundage, you realize that that took place in 1936. And you know, anyone who follows sports and the Olympics knows that Avery Brundage's last Olympics was the 1972 Olympic Games, where the 11 Israeli athletes were killed by terrorists. And the same Avery Brundage who probably conspired to keep Marty out of the Games was the same Avery Brundage who insisted that the Games continue, while lots of other nations were saying that maybe they should cancel the Games. So it is interesting that you see this in 1936, and then all those years later, it's the same Avery Brundage.
Not only that, but look at the 2012 Olympics. It was the 40-year anniversary of the Munich massacre, and they wanted a moment of silence. And during the opening ceremonies, and the U.S. and the International Olympic Committee denied them that moment. And now, of course, we have everything with Russia hosting the next Olympics, and instead of anti-Semitism, it seems to be homophobia. So the more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess, right?
Exactly. Now, after the Games, Marty returns to the States to star, as you mentioned, on the Syracuse football team. He's a pretty good player, but he knew his future wasn't as a pro. He gets offered a nighttime radio show for $15 a broadcast, which is about $14 more than I'm making now.
That's not good because you have to factor in inflation. He was probably making $50 with inflation.
Exactly. He developed quite a niche in sports broadcasting. There's so much great archival audio in the documentary. So I was wondering, how many hours of audio did you actually listen to, and where did most of it come from?
Great question. People say, how long did it take to make a film? I say, a year to make it and 2 years to find and beg for free footage. The audio, I got 70 hours of it through Stan Isaacs, who many people here may remember was a great writer for Newsday. He just passed away this past April. And he wrote a book with Marty called The Fastest Kid on the Block, and the transcripts that he made the book off of with Marty, recorded on the old-fashioned little tape recorder, he gave me that, and he had donated it to Syracuse University, and they misplaced them, and it took me about 6 months to get them. And then one day, 70 CDs came at my door, and I listened to all of them. And, they were not broadcast quality, so we really had to work. A lot of things we weren't able to use that I wish we could have, but we did use what we could. And then I found other interviews Marty had done later in life. What happens with these people is they're so busy working that many of their interviews are done after they retire, where they really talk in depth. And then I just had so many wonderful organizations, when I said what I was doing, donate footage so I could, really show this film, because I had to come up with 70 years of footage from the 30s to the year 2000.
He did a wonderful job weaving it all together.
Thank you so much.
Following graduation, he moves back to New York, marries his high school sweetheart, Marge, and made a name for himself doing dramatic recreations of baseball games. It's hard to explain to the Twitter age what exactly that was. It's something that Ronald Reagan did, the great Ernie Harwell.
Yes.
Ernie Harwell we had on the show talking about the way he used to do it. So many others did it as well. Can you fill our audience in exactly what it was, and why was Marty so good at it?
Marty actually claims doing today's baseball, which was a dramatized recreation of the games of the day, taught him how to broadcast. What it was is that you would get off the wire. It was like, if they don't know what that is, it was like you would see, like, if it were today, you would see Jeter pops up to second, Rodriguez strikes out swinging, and, who's another Yankee, Grandison or whatever, hits a double off the left field wall. So that's all that came in on the wire, and then all of these announcers would then have to take that information, and you could make it the most exciting pop-up in the history of baseball, or you had free reign. You had to fill in, all right, pitch one, strike on the outside. You literally in your mind recreated off of what it said on the wire. And Marty was so effective at this that people would deliberately stay away from the score during the day so they could come home. It was a 15-minute show, so they quickly recreated. He might say, the Yankees go down 1-2-3 in the bottom of the third, and now we're in the top of the fourth, and, the Detroit Tigers are leading off with whoever's up at bat, whoever it was. And people wanted to hear Marty do that recreation to experience the game that way.
The beauty of the documentary to me is there are so many different sub-stories woven into the fabric of the film. One story, which is actually a New York Times bestseller, the name of the book is called Unbroken, and I'm sure it's going to be a movie one day, is the story of...
Angelina Jolie is directing that movie.
There you go. It's a story of Louis Zamperini. Can you tell our audience a little bit of Louis's story and how Marty is connected to him?
Yes. Actually, I will tell you how I came to decide to do this movie. I'd been a writer in Hollywood for many years, and I'd never made a documentary. And my writing partner just had her second child, and I decided to think about doing this documentary on Marty Glickman. So I read his autobiography. I came across one incredible story after another, until I came across the story of his most memorable broadcast, the Lou Zamperini Memorial Mile. And I'll tell you about that in a second. And what happened was that Lou Zamperini was lost in World War II on a rescue mission. His plane crashed. 9 of the 12 men were killed. He saved the other two. They were on a raft in the Pacific Ocean for 43 days. And then their raft washes ashore on an island, and they think they're saved. Unfortunately, it's a Japanese-occupied island, which we used to call Execution Island. He is basically kept there and virtually tortured for 2 years. He is declared dead in the interim. Marty Glickman arranges and has the first Lou Zamperini Memorial Mile at Madison Square Garden. In the following, when the war ended and Lou Zamperini came back, they had the second and final Lou Zamperini Memorial Mile, and Lou Zamperini was the one who shot off the starting gun in his own memorial race.
In full uniform. That's a great shot.
In full uniform.
Yeah. It's an incredible. Just that shot alone is just priceless. It's just
so
great
stuff.
So this
is what I want to tell you. So now you have the story. So I finish reading the story, and the phone rings. I haven't decided to make this movie. And it's a friend of mine I haven't spoken to in a while. And he says, what are you up to? And I said, well, I'm actually thinking about maybe doing this documentary on Marty Glickman. He said, what's stopping you? And I said, look, it's a huge undertaking. I've never made a film before. And the idea of doing this by myself is pretty scary. And I then proceeded to tell him the Lou Zamperini story. My friend said, are you sitting down? I said, yes. He said, Lou Zamperini is my next door neighbor.
Oh, wow.
I said, I said, I'm doing this film. And so I did. And in fact, Lou Zamperini was my very first interview.
Wow. That's great stuff. It just,
you know, I'm not a guy who believes, I don't believe in signs. That was a sign.
You think? So now, after the war, Marty recognized that there seemed to be probably more of a broadcasting opportunity in basketball, which was only a fringe sport at the time, than the other sports. He truly changed the way sports were called. I think Larry King described it best in the documentary, saying that he was television on radio. Can you,
I love that quote.
Yeah, it was one of my favorites. Can you explain how Marty gave listeners a full layout of the court and what some of his signature calls were? Because I love the way you did it in the film.
Marty literally revolutionized play-by-play radio broadcasting, and broadcasters today are using all of his terminology without knowing it came from him. He coined the phrases the key, the lane, the top of the circle, the midcourt stripe, and his most famous swish. But what he really did was he gave listeners the geography of the court. Prior to Marty Glickman, a broadcast would sound like this. Rosenman passes to Friedman, Friedman passes to Smith, he scores. You didn't know where anyone was. Marty, by giving the geography, would say, Rosenman dribbles up along the right sideline, throws a bounce pass to the top of the key to Friedman. Friedman throws a behind-the-back pass to Smith in the corner. He drives in and throws in a one-handed running bank shot. You saw the game. And that's what he did.
And of course, the two Jewish kids didn't score. You had to make the other guy score, huh?
He had the assist.
That's true. Now, incredibly enough, and this
you got the hockey assist. I got the assist now that you mentioned.
There you go. So now here's another recurring theme with Marty, and it almost kills you because you see what happens at the Olympics, all right? Marty is instrumental in getting the NBA a TV contract, okay? He's replaced because he sounds too Jewish, too New York. The guy who replaces him becomes later on a New York icon because he's the longtime announcer of the Mets, Lindsey Nelson. Marty, though, kept working, broadcasting New York Knicks games and narrating the newsreels. And then he found a whole new generation as the Giants' football voice during their golden age of the 50s and 60s. You watched a lot of tape as well as the audio. Marty played both football and basketball. And which of those sports do you think Marty did play-by-play best of?
You know, I would say he was a genius at doing a sport with movement, and both of those sports certainly have them. And I would say you could not compare the two. He was so exciting when he did Giant games, and I would listen to those games, and I would be, it was thrilling. I'll tell you a quick story. I interviewed Frank Gifford, and I brought a tape as a gift of the Giant game of Marty talking about announcing Frank Gifford making these incredible catches. And Gifford's listening to the tape, and he has this look on his face. I go, Frank, what's going on? And he says, you have to understand something. I've never heard this. I said, what do you mean you've never heard it? He said, well, back then when something was broadcast on the air, that was it. It went into the airwaves. You never heard it again. There was no internet. There was no, and I was playing, so I never heard Marty Glickman broadcast my games until just now.
Wow, it's incredible. You know, the legacy and the people he's touched. You know, if you had to think about it, obviously there's a whole generation that associates him with the Knicks, another generation with the Giants, and then still another one, the Jets. Which would you say he is probably the closest team that he's associated with?
The Giants.
The Giants.
Because the Jet teams were not that good. The Knick teams, while they were very good, it was still a fringe sport. But he was at the advent of when pro football burst on the scene, you know, in 58 with the Johnny Unitas famous game at Yankee Stadium. And then in the early 60s, when those New York Giant teams, for people who don't remember, they lost all three games, but they went to three championship games. But these people were celebrities. They were the first athletes with TV endorsement deals. We're talking about, and most of the listeners' fathers will probably know this, but people like Sam Huff, Frank Gifford, Y.A. Tittle, Del Schaffner. These are guys that literally would own the city when they walked down the city. And so you had that great, rare combination of a team, a great broadcaster, and a team of mythical athletes. And it doesn't happen that often.
Another thing that surprises you is he did the high school game of the week. And now with the advent of cable TV and entire networks like MSG Varsity built around high school sports, it might not seem like a big deal. But back then, it was really unheard of. And can you explain what Marty Glickman coming to a high school and doing a high school team sport meant to the school and the athletes of the day back then?
Charlie Steiner, the Dodger announcer, I think he used to also be the Yankee announcer, he said it, when you heard Marty Glickman was coming to do the game of your high school, it was like the Beatles were coming. And hopefully your listeners remember the Beatles. You know. But the point is, this was, you know, Marty not only wanted to show the public that these kids were doing good things by doing the high school game of the week. And think about it. Here was his schedule. He Friday night did the Knick games, Saturday night Yonkers Raceway, Sunday afternoon the Giants games, and he's making time to go to some high school on Saturday morning on a freezing cold day, sit in some, you know, rickety wooden booth and broadcast these games. And then at halftime, bring in the Glee Club, the Chess Club, you know, not just jocks, you know, the cheerleaders, the debating society, to show people all the good that these young kids were doing in the city. He also worked with the Police Athletic League. He did an enormous amount to help the youth of New York City. And in his mind, he was paying back how they helped him when he was a star athlete in New York.
And the footage of the guys who, a lot of them became sports writers, talking about that, which is priceless as well. We look at HBO and HBO Sports as one of the leaders of the industry. Many people would be shocked to know that Marty Glickman was the first person to be heard on air on HBO, helping launch the network's sports division with innovations such as early round coverage of Wimbledon tennis. Most of us that know Marty and remember him, like his broadcast, even I remember him. I think at one time he might have done ABC, like sports, like during the Eyewitness News towards the very end. You'd look at him and you'd hear him and you would describe him as old school, but yet he really was one of the biggest innovative minds in the industry. Why do you think Marty is not known outside the industry as much as, say, maybe a Rune Arledge or a Steve Sable are?
You know, he never hung his hat on that, and I think all the attention went to what a great broadcaster he was. Because one of the things I forgot to mention, when he was doing those Giant games, they were blacked out in New York when they were home games, so you never saw a home game unless you had a ticket. The only way to experience New York football on a Sunday when they were home was through listening to Marty Glickman. You know, and people say, did you see the game? They say, yes, I saw it on the radio with Marty.
Wow. His daughter talking about how people would bring their radios to the game and just how he was everywhere. And the pictures that you shot there were awesome as well. You know, NBC,
you.
I spoke to Bruce Beck, who actually was also tutored by Marty. You talk about how he coached a lot of the network announcers, including Gail Sarans, who remains the only woman in history to call an NFL game. In the film, there's a list of names that scroll across the screen of announcers who Marty has coached. His legacy lives on today, and through those announcers, it's been passed down to yet another generation. So can you fill our audience in a little bit of who those announcers are that Marty helped along in their careers?
The main person he mentored that was so close to Marty is, of course, Marv Albert. And through Marv Albert, Mike Breen. And Bob Costas is one. Kurt Gowdy, who they may not remember, was one. There are many. Spiro Dinas, the Knick announcer now, was in the last class that Marty taught. And it just goes on and on and on. He was of sort of the Don Corleone of the Syracuse announcing group that still, you know, Len Berman, Dick Stockton, and then he taught at Fordham for 20 years. And he would teach anybody. He was so giving of his time. Charlie Steiner told me a story where he didn't know Marty personally, and he gets a call from him saying, I heard you do a USFL football game. Why don't you bring your tapes, come over tomorrow, and we'll go over them. And Charlie thought someone was playing a joke on him. And he goes to visit Marty, and Charlie says in the film he learned more in those 3 hours with Marty Glickman than he had in the previous 15 years of his career.
I tell you, Charlie's been touched by an angel. I mean, to get to work with Marty Glickman and now to see Vince Scully on a daily basis, not bad stuff.
Yes. Yeah, he loves working with Vince Scully. Yeah.
What is your favorite Marty Glickman story?
I really don't have a favorite story. I mean, there's so many, so many poignant stories. I would say this, it's not a story so much, because, there's so many wonderful moments. It was really his approach to sport that I found, he found the joy of sports, the purity of sports. And today, I have two young boys, and you try and talk sports, you can hardly read the papers with the DUIs and the steroids and attacks on women. And for Marty Glickman, the way he broadcast, the feel that he had, the feeling he got across, it was the joy of sport. It was almost primal, the way a kid has a catch with his parent, his father, and how you feel when you're doing that. That's what Marty Glickman loved about sport and loved about broadcasting, to convey that to the audience. And he was almost like a little kid, but a little kid with an enormous amount of professional understanding of how to broadcast when he broadcast. And that's what comes across. You, for people of a certain age, over 40 or whatever, if you grew up in New York in the latter part of the 20th century and were any bit of a sports fan, Marty Glickman was part of the soundtrack of your life.
Absolutely, and it comes through crystal clear in the wonderful film. Thanks so much for your time tonight, James, and more importantly, thanks for this great film. James L. Friedman, the writer, director, producer of Glickman, illuminating the life and legacy of the man who pioneered modern sports reporting, debuts tomorrow night exclusively on HBO.